Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Jason Frank, the author of The Democratic Sublime, on Aesthetics and Popular Assembly. This book was published by Oxford University Press in 2021, and it is a theoretical sort of examination of our understanding of popular assembly and popular demonstration and the people in democracies. But I'm going to let Jason tell us a lot more about that. First, I'd like to welcome Jason Frank to the New Books Network and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Lily. Thank you for inviting me. How I came to this project, I guess, you know, I started thinking about this book about 10 years ago when I was in the process of finishing my second book called Publius in Political Imagination. And, you know, this was around 2011. And as you probably remember, 2011 was a year that was marked by the emergence of a really quite global wave of protests against, you know, some of the ramifications and the inequalities that were exposed by the financial crisis of 2008. So I'm thinking of, you know, obviously Occupy Wall Street, but the Indignados in Spain, you know, what became the Syriza movement in Greece. And it was really quite a global kind of phenomenon. Gezi came shortly after that. And all of this in the aftermath of course, the Arab Spring and the revolutions that accompanied the Arab Spring. And, you know, it got me to think a bit in a more sustained way than I had previously about the centrality of popular assembly, the politics of crowds, demonstrations, gatherings of the people out of doors, the centrality of these phenomena to the emergence and really the entire history of modern democracy and popular sovereignty across a wide range of different histories and geographies, and the surprise really on my part that democratic theorists, you know, historians, sociologists, cultural anthropologists had written about these phenomena with great insight and nuance, but democratic theorists really had very little to say about the central role that popular assembly, which is the term that I kind of broadly use in the book to capture these different phenomena, play in the modern democratic imaginary. I mean, they're obviously a very important part of the ancient democratic political imaginary as well. But my work has really tracked and been interested in dilemmas and problems that emerge with the emergence of popular sovereignty as a hegemonic legitimating norm in the West, and then kind of more broadly beginning at the end of the 18th century and then, you know, up until the present day, when I think it's being directly challenged in a lot of interesting ways. So I came to the project really with that kind of political question in mind. And I had written a chapter on crowds and the communication of crowds in my first book, In Constituent Moments, but I really thought that it was worth a much more sustained theoretical and historical engagement kind of with some of the questions of democratic theory front and center in my mind, but also the questions that I came to be convinced that democratic theory and democratic theorists have tended to neglect about the popular assembly, even though, as I said, popular assembly has just been a central part, I think, of the modern history of democracy and is a central component of the modern democratic political imaginary. So that's the kind of, in the broadest sense, you know, that's how I came to be interested in the questions that ultimately led to the book.
And in the discussion of popular assembly, as you're talking about it, there is the form that it takes when we think about a legislature, where we have elected representatives, or in the Rousseauian case, you know, sort of the people themselves. But that you're also talking about what happens in the streets. Yeah. And how are those two points connected in this work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so you're right. I'm in this book, and it gets developed with the concept of the democratic sublime. You know, I am primarily focused on informal protest collectivities that are, I mean, I love this 18th century phrase. I mean, it's primarily an Anglophone phrase. And as you know, from looking at the book, this book is not really focused as much on the US case or a little bit on Britain, but this phrase, gatherings of the people out of doors, I think captures, is one way to respond to your question. I mean, what 18th century writers meant by that phrase was both literal gatherings of the people in the streets and in the public squares, but out of doors also meant out of the formal chambers and assemblies of representative political institutions, parliaments, legislatures. And I am interested in the continued power and distinctive power, really, of these informal collective assemblies in democratic life as a distinctive form of democratic representation. They are also democratic representations, even though they are embodied instantiations of collectivities. But I see them, as you know, still as a form of democratic representation, but democratic representation that emerges beyond or alongside the formal representative institutions of the state, like a legislature. I mean, oftentimes the primary claim across a widely varied history of popular assembly in democratic contexts is that, you know, the people in those formal institutions of representation do not actually represent the people. So there is a kind of a claim to representation among popular assemblies that is more genuine, more true, more than the kind of in various ways unrepresentative institutions or delegitimated institutions of the state. But I still want to insist that it is still a representation, but just a very distinctive kind of representation. You know, I'm focused in this book, and this is one of the ways in which this project, you know, links up to other debates in contemporary democratic theory on constituent power. I'm interested in you know, these moments when the formal representative bodies of governance are so deeply contested that the way in which the people say gets converted into an electorate, like a legally authorized entity, are so deeply contested that they in effect become deauthorized, and they open up a space for different forms of democratic representation that are not reducible to the legally authorized representations of the state.
And I had a conversation last week with three authors of a new book on the phantoms of the beleaguered republic, where they talk at length about the deep state. And that is about the sort of deauthorization and delegitimization of the state itself, which is a representative form of government. But before we go there, let me ask a little bit more about the sort of basic thesis of the book, which is about this, you know, this sort of constructing of peoplehood in a certain sense, and in context of this concept of the sublime or sublime. And you spend a lot of time defining what sublime meant, particularly in the 1800s. And you know, again, we don't necessarily use that term a lot in terms of when we discuss crowds in politics. And so I would love for you to explain how this is essentially the thread that holds the thesis together in a lot of ways.
Sure. I think you're right that we, you know, I meant for the title of the book, and also for its core concept of the democratic sublime, to already in the title be a bit defamiliarizing, in the sense that, especially when you're thinking of crowds and demonstrations, gatherings of the people out of doors, the broader aesthetics of sublimity might not be the first thing that would occur to you as a kind of aesthetic concept and tradition that could give us access into the distinctive dynamics of popular assembly and democratic context. But that is, of course, what I'm arguing. So let me take, I think the best way to answer that question, Lily, is to maybe take a little bit of a step back, and I'll paint with fairly broad strokes here. But one of the stories that democratic theorists, at least, but not only democratic theorists, often tell themselves about the emergence of modern democracy in the revolutions of the late 18th century and then into the 19th century is a story of democratic disenchantment, right? And that is the idea, again, broadly, that when popular sovereignty replaces the sovereignty of kings, royal sovereignty, one of the important changes that comes about is that the authority of royalism, which was based on a kind of, you know, you think about the kind of ritualized authority of the person of the king and the pomp and the circumstance that attends royal ceremony and ritual, these kind of these portrayals of power in front of a beholden, bedazzled, but largely passive group of constituency of subjects, when that is replaced by forms of democratic self-rule, the transformation of subjects into citizens, we often think of that process as a process of disenchantment, where the authority of the king and of royalty is replaced more by a more ratio-critical, deliberative, truly representative authority of the people themselves consenting to forms of political and state power based on what they perceive as their interests, what is reason, what is right. There's various ways to kind of flesh out this broader thesis of disenchantment. But I think a lot goes And this is, by the way, you know, this is an important story. You find it already at the end of the 18th century in somebody like Thomas Paine and his Rights of Man. But you also find it in the work of Jürgen Habermas very influentially in a more contemporary kind of theoretical context. So I think that the democratic disenchantment story is misleading in important ways, because as popular sovereignty becomes an increasingly hegemonic norm of political legitimacy over the course of the late 18th and into the 19th century, it also requires entirely new investments of popular imagination, entirely new forms of collective fantasy, you might say. And that elicitation of imagination and fantasy occurs especially around the constituent subject of democratic legitimacy, which is the figure of the people. So if you can think about the discourse of the king's two bodies, or kind of ideas of royal authority where sovereignty is invested in the body of the king, right? And there might be, you know, there are theological trappings to that discourse, but at least the king's body doesn't have to be imagined. The king's body can be seen. It is at the center of royal iconography. The people's body is never visible in that way. It requires of the citizenry to imagine that they are a part of this newly sovereign collectivity in a way that requires kind of investments of the imagination that I think are wholly new to modern democracy, and that I try to engage in this book. So when you just bring up, Lily, the kind of question of problems of peoplehood, problems of peopling, these are familiar debates in contemporary democratic theory, and not only in democratic theory. I mean, this is, you know, more broadly in political science. You can look to, back to Benedict Anderson's very important work on the emergence of nationalism, or Roger Smith's more recent work on stories of peoplehood. We're working in a similar kind of terrain here, although I'm really bringing the questions of democratic theory front and center. I have argued in this book that aesthetic considerations are essential, really, for understanding these debates around the contours of the people, how the people is imagined, how democratic citizens imagine themselves and experience themselves. It's not just experience themselves kind of viscerally, to be a part of a newly empowered collectivity, this new sovereign form of peoplehood. So that is the kind of broader, I don't know how much you want to dig into details about like the importance of aesthetic considerations for approaching these questions of peoplehood. It's very important, I think, to the overall architecture of the book's argument. But more specifically, now you're asking about the question of the sublime. So the sublime is a particular aesthetic register, obviously. And one of the things that happens over this same period is that the sublime, the aesthetics of the sublime is what I characterize in the book as immanentized, right? So sublime experience goes from being an experience of transcendence. You can think especially of kind of religious transcendence as the locus of a kind of sublime experience of that which exceeds human reason, human instrumentality and use and so on. But it goes from being that experience of transcendence to being something that is experienced within the secular realm of human action itself. Now, this is a broad reorientation, aesthetic reorientation in the West, often associated with romanticism. But it's also something that is engaged by a number of canonical political theorists. And in the book, I have single chapters that go quite into depth and detail, looking at the work of Rousseau and Burke and Tocqueville, all of whom I think are powerful examples of this broader immanentization of the sublime in the West. So one form that that immanentization takes, and I lay this out probably most clearly in the chapter called The Living Image of the People, which is kind of the central, it's in the middle of the book, and it's one of the first things that I wrote. It really kind of set the tracks for me, for the book's larger argument, is that the people themselves become a source of sublime experience. And because the people are the sovereign, right? The people are the sovereign power. But instantiations of the people in their physically assembled form, I argue, become particularly important carriers of this experience of the popular sublime. So there's a quote that I return to at several times in the book and that I thought about using as an epigraph for the book, but for various reasons decided to use Tocqueville instead. But it comes from Robespierre, who at one point before the convention says, "The people must see themselves assembled in order to feel their power." So that's the quote. This idea, this kind of the being a part of a collective and witnessing, kind of experiencing yourself as a part of the of a collective that is also more than the empirically gathered people, but is a carrier of this broader normative entity of the people, you know, the people themselves. The people is the source of sovereign authority. There's a kind of ineffability to that experience, which is very important to the broader aesthetics of the sublime. The sublime is, you know, the presentation of that which cannot be represented. And, you know, I don't know how much how deep into the details of this you want to go, but that's the general kind of way in which this idea of popular assembly as a carry of the democratic sublime is kind of framed in the book and then gets developed in different ways across its different chapters.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And the chapter that I thought really helped me to understand your conceptualization of the sublime in this context was the chapter on Burke. In part probably because, as you note, he really spends his time sort of talking about it in a political and philosophical sort of context or understanding. But you do talk, I mean, it's sort of Rousseau, Burke, Tocqueville, at the second half of the book, who are all sort of working on, and you're working through them to understand and see the conceptualization of essentially what is a, you know, the form of the people embodied and beyond embodied.
Exactly.
And so can you explain a little bit about how, in particular, Burke, but, you know, sort of these thinkers really helped you to understand this path towards the sort of sublime as the aesthetic notion for understanding democracy with the people, the physical yeah. entity of the people.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll start by saying something about Burke, and then it might be helpful in answering your question to give you a sense of why the chapters are kind of organized in the way that they are. So you're right to emphasize Burke's importance to the project. I mean, just in terms of how the project got going, the first thing that I wrote was the piece on Burke that came out in a different form in a collection called Political Theory's Aesthetic Turn, or The Aesthetic Turn in Political Thought. I thought that, I mean, first of all, Burke is a profoundly anti-democratic thinker. I think it's important to emphasize that, because I am making a case that democratic theorists actually have a lot to learn from Burke in the things that he takes to be essential, especially political aesthetics. The importance of Burke's earlier aesthetics as they are kind of philosophically developed in his inquiry into the beautiful and the sublime, how that basic work of philosophical aesthetics becomes, I think, essential for understanding Burke's more explicitly political work, whether that be, you know, his the trial of Warren Hastings and his critique of the excesses and domination of British colonial governance, or especially in the anti-revolutionary writings on French, which is what I obviously focus on here. So in that chapter, I do make an argument that the experience of the revolution, and especially aestheticized appeal, affirmative appeal, the enthusiasm that was generated on the part of British radicals for the revolution's promise, not just in France, but kind of in a broader kind of global revolutionary context that they hoped would lead to radical reforms in Britain itself, that led to a kind of reevaluation and redeployment of Burke's understanding of the sublime, where he more expressly immanentizes it. It turns into a problem of historicism, the inheritance of the ancient constitution. But most scholars of Burke's work would agree that you can't read a work like The Reflections on the Revolution in France and really understand the arguments that are being made there without having some clear familiarity with Burke's political aesthetics. So Burke is, Burke is a canonical political theorist, an anti-democratic thinker, who nonetheless takes seriously the kind of problems of political aesthetics, especially around conceptions of belonging, peoplehood, the generation of public authority, that I am very interested in exploring in a more radically democratic vein in this book. So I'm kind of working with Burke against Burke. I think Burke has much more to tell us. We have much more to learn from Burke on these questions than we do from his great nemesis, the prophet of modern popular sovereignty, in a lot of ways, Thomas Paine. I'll leave that aside. So you're right. So I have the book, when I was trying to figure out how best to explore, you know, these kind of broad changes in aesthetics and legitimating norms in political life, the emergence of popular sovereignty, I didn't want to just tell that story through authorial, you know, chapters focused on canonical political theorists. Although I thought it was important to have those chapters so you could really dig in to some of the conceptual nuance and rigor of thinkers like Rousseau, Burke, and Tocqueville. But as you know, where the chapters kind of zoom in to focus on these canonical theorists, between those chapters, there are chapters that, you know, I'm kind of using these cinematic metaphors that kind of zoom out and tell broader stories about the change in the iconography of sovereign rule from the 17th century into the early 19th century, a chapter on the poetics of the barricades, which were very important to, you know, a broader visual culture and literary culture in the first half of the 19th century, and that I see as powerful examples of how this problem of the democratic sublime gets navigated in different art forms, you know, and that can be anywhere from the paintings of David to the novels of Hugo, and especially, you know, I spent a fair amount of time on book 10 from Les Miserables, and that chapter on barricades, but also visual culture, woodcuts of barricades. You know, I thought having a fairly idiosyncratic, but also widely disseminated archive, I guess, for this book was important, because I was trying to capture something that was going to, I think, hopefully speak in productive ways to both historically oriented democratic theory, but then also to what I take to be an unfortunate neglect of these questions in a lot of contemporary democratic theory. But it's also, you know, it's looking at the memoirs of radicals, and it's looking at poetry. I thought it was important to really expand the archive beyond canonical works of political theory in the West.
Yeah, and that was, you say in the introduction, you use Walter Benjamin's sort of characterization of it not being sort of linear, but a sort of constellation of points that draw together into a whole. And I found that to be particularly useful in guiding me through reading the book. So as not to expect that we're going to go from Hobbes to Rousseau to Tocqueville sort of in an, you know, sort of way, a history of political theory way. But I do want to ask you a little bit more about the focus in particular on the role of France and the French experience with regard to the multiple different forms of assembly and the people as really a kind of backbone of the discussion. Because as you note, it's not about the American Revolution per se, and it's not necessarily about other sort of revolts or undertakings, although they are included. The French experience is more central. And can you explain a bit about why that is the case in this age of revolution?
Right. Do we need another book about the French Revolution? That is true. I mean, I think, Lily, that a part of, the motivations behind the book, both the political motivations that I said a bit about at the beginning of our conversation, but also the theoretical motivations, are meant to be very contemporary. You know, I mean, that's why I did spend a fair amount of time in the introduction. I do historically situated democratic theory. You know, I like being, and I think it's important for democratic theory to be attentive to the nuances of context. But I am not, you know, this is not a simple contextual, I mean, that's a problematic term in a lot of ways too, but I think you know what I mean. It's a shorthand. You know, I'm not a historian. And I'm certainly not a historian of 19th century France. All of the kind of theoretical and political problems around popular assembly and the democratic imaginary that I lay out, both in the long introduction, then in the chapter on popular manifestations, which engages with Lefort and the work of Carl Schmitt, two very influential contemporary democratic theorists or 20th century democratic theorists who primarily theorized democracy through their historical retellings of the history of the French Revolution. That was important for me. And then, you know, I have an afterword that engages with Rancière's work. None of this is to justify limiting the archive to primarily French sources, but it is to say that what I hope to do, and, you know, this is a fairly new archive for me. You know, I mean, I've written on some of these figures before, but my first two books were really focused on the United States. So I became interested in how the French sources that I engage in this book, you know, I thought were productive ways to think about some of the contemporary political and theoretical problems that the book is meant to engage. So there are limitations, of course, and I certainly would never claim that the French case, as I reconstructed the French case, stands in as a universal example that can simply be plopped down and you know, implemented across a wider history and across different geographies and so on. Not at all. I do think that some of the questions that I engage and reconstruct with this kind of constellation with these French sources, I think you're right, that Benjamin idea, which a number of people have taken up, I think that certain theorists mean different things by it. But I do hope that even though this is a historically situated work, that some of the theoretical problems that I reconstruct here can be productive to theorists and to historians working in very different geographic and historical contexts. Doesn't mean that they're simply going to be, you know, as I said, theoretical constructs that can travel without any blowback of the particular. Not at all. But I do think the questions I'm interested in are more broadly applicable, I guess, than just the late 18th and, you know, I'm looking kind of 1776 to 1848, the age of revolutions. So that's the hope. I mean, I think that there are particularities to the French context that will not carry, and that's fine. But I'm not trying to construct a universal theory here of the democratic sublime. I'm much more a partisan of other people doing democratic theory in these more contextually, historically situated ways.
And I mean, that was sort of what I found, is that you reached for examples to sort of flesh out some of these concepts of what it means to be a people, and activated as such, and how to conceptualize yourself as such. And that was my next question. Is, can you dig into a little bit this idea of the living image of the people, and which, you know, I kept thinking about as I was reading, myself having marched in any number of marches, myself being a voter, talking to students about voting, obviously, and also understanding themselves as citizens. And then seeing on television, of course, these, you know, shots of the Women's March or Black Lives Matter last summer, and sort of understanding what that is in our imagination, and how that teaches us a bit about being in a democracy.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that was so striking to me about the protests in Tahrir Square, you know, ultimately led to the revolution, is that, you know, the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that gathered in Tahrir, eventually started setting up large screens in the square where they could watch themselves being covered on the international news. I mean, it was this kind of updated version of the people kind of watching themselves and their power as it is taken up in different contexts and represented to themselves. And that dynamic of collective self-regard and the kind of the aesthetic contours of that experience, to me, I think that that was something that really, you know, was kind of in the back of my mind as I was beginning to think about this project in its early stages. So, so Lily, remind me just quickly, like, so
this question really broadly of the living image of the people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, your example of Tahrir Square is great, but to some degree, some more of the details of the tension also.
Yeah, of course. Okay. So what I'm, so that chapter, you know, begins with debates in the 17th century during the English Civil War about where, you know, that is a pivotal moment in the middle of the 17th century for the gradual emergence of a new norm of what will become towards the end of the next century, the full-blown theory of popular sovereignty as a theory of political legitimacy. But you see emerging ideas of popular sovereignty in the middle of the 17th century in these debates around the English Civil War with, you know, figures like the Levellers, for example, but even in social contract theorists, I mean, even in Thomas Hobbes, obviously, you know, who is no fan of democracy, but the idea that that public authority ultimately rests in some kind of idea of consent contract is a very important part of that history, very contested. So it's a Civil War context. But also during that period, you have these aesthetic iconographical debates on how the people as a new source of public authority can be depicted and represented. I mean, there was such a well-worn tradition of royal sovereignty and portraiture focused again on the body of the king and the ceremonial authority that emanates from that body. I mean, it's a kind of classically elaborated by Ernst Kantorovich in The King's Two Bodies. But what I do in that chapter is kind of begin with those debates, look at the debates over royal iconography then across the channel in France in the 17th and into the 18th century as a way of setting up both the normative dilemmas that emerge with the French Revolution in 1789, but also the attending aesthetic problems of how to represent popular will, how to represent the people's sovereignty, and the kind of intransigent persistence, I guess, of certain kinds of royalist iconography, even into radically democratizing context, you know, figured by in that chapter the figure of the Hercules, the as the figure of the sovereign people. So the living image of the people, what becomes interesting to me, and I think, Lily, if I had written this chapter now, I would have amplified, I would have brought this point out more clearly. But one of the things that you see in the kind of outlined history, I mean, I'm covering a lot of ground in that chapter and relying heavily on historians and art historians to make the arguments that I make there. But one of the things that you see in this movement from kind of the royal portraiture and iconography of the king in the 17th across the 18th century into ideas of how you depict the new sovereign, this new sovereign form, the people, is that it leaves the surface of the canvas. It leaves the sculptural work in the case of the Hercules and, you know, David's proposals and so on, which I won't go into in any detail in our conversation, but that are an important part of that chapter. And it actually becomes embodied in physical gatherings of the people, performances, ceremonial performances, especially in the festivals of the French Revolution, which are, you know, well known. Mona Azouf has, you know, probably the most influential book on it, where Rousseau plays a very important role. But that transmission of the aesthetic presentation of sovereign form from a kind of iconography into a living, that is what the living image of the people is. It is an image, it still is a representation, but it's one that resists sedimentation, or I guess reification, because it is actually, it comes to be invested in the collective body itself, and not just in the highly orchestrated festivals of the French Revolution, but ultimately in these less orchestrated, more spontaneous, more improvisational iterations of popular gathering and popular assembly across this democratic history. So that's that kind of transmission, and there's an aesthetic contour to that experience, but from, you know, the art object, you might say, into the performance of peoplehood by embodied collectivity themselves. That is an important part of the story I'm telling in that chapter, but I think I would have brought it out more in precisely these terms if I were to rewrite that chapter today. It often happens that way.
I understand. I had been a participant in the Chicago Women's March in 2017, and we marched, and then we were sitting having a drink later, and the news was telling us that the march had been canceled. And so I think this is also somewhat of an example of what you are talking about in terms of my experience and me being told by officials that there was no march.
There's nothing to see here. Nothing happened.
Because it was so big, they said it was canceled. Okay. Yeah. that was very much of an aside. But I did want to bring you towards the final afterword. As you know, you have a preface and you have an afterword, which are sort of novel for book, academic books in particular. And you sort of, you know, you have this afterwards where you talk about how Rancière is really the foremost contemporary thinker on this idea of aesthetics and politics as a kind of coda for the book. Can you explain just a little bit about like why he got dropped there?
Yeah. Well, look, the entire book is, you know, makes a kind of sustained argument for democratic theorists to take political aesthetics more seriously than they have, and to engage the questions that I've been, you know, reconstructing, kind of unpacking in the previous chapters around people, around the aesthetic role of popular empowerment and the particularly distinctive role that collective assembly plays. You know, it really is, it's about like what political aesthetics can contribute to contemporary debates in democratic theory, partly by looking back at canonical democratic theorists for whom these questions were essential, Rousseau and Tocqueville. I mean, obviously Burke, but again, Burke's not a democratic thinker. So I turn in the afterword to Rancière, because Rancière, insofar as contemporary democratic theorists or political theorists more broadly have engaged with questions of aesthetics in, you know, the so-called aesthetic turn in political thought, I don't think it's controversial to say that Rancière has been the most influential theorist of thinking politics and aesthetics together. I've learned a great deal from Rancière. I've written about him in other contexts, and I wanted to kind of return to Rancière. You know, Rancière thinks the relationship between aesthetics and politics through this influential idea of the partage du sensible, like the distribution, the partition of the sensible and the redistribution of the sensible. Both aesthetics and politics overlap. They're not the same for Rancière, but they overlap and interweave around this question of the distribution of the sensible. So I wanted to kind of revisit that theory with an eye, I guess, if I'm adding something to contemporary interpretations of Rancière, I make an argument in that chapter that he is developing a distinctive theory of democratic appearance in his work that has maybe not been sufficiently appreciated, but that I think, as you say, tacking him on at the end of this historical reconstruction, it allows us to see that there is this theory of democratic appearance that is important in his work. And, you know, Rancière himself is, you know, his contributions to contemporary democratic theory, I mean, they're not limited to Disagreement, to the book that, you know, that has been most important for contemporary democratic theorists, but he really came to these questions by himself looking for 10 years at the archive of working class protest politics in France in the first half of the 19th century, you know? So I also thought that, you know, Rancière's own, his own version of a kind of historically situated approach to democratic theory, I thought could provide a productive juxtaposition, not only for the, you know, for some continuities in that we're both interested in the interweaving of aesthetics and politics, but also important discontinuities. I think that Rancière's, the theory of democratic appearance that I try to build from his work, but also engaging it with the work of a terrific contemporary artist named Glenn Ligon, who, you know, half of the chapter is really on Glenn Ligon's work, a series of paintings that he did around the Million Man March. But there's differences. I think that Rancière is very focused on the dynamics of disidentification in democratic and popular appearance. And, you know, in the book, I'm not focused on identification exactly. I think to the contrary. But I wouldn't say that the dynamics of disidentification that are so important to Rancière's idea of democratic appearance are the same as my, that kind of aesthetic contour, the aesthetic contours of experiencing oneself as a newly empowered collectivity that is the source of a newly enthroned sovereign power, and the kind of collective dynamics of that, that is not Rancière's central preoccupation. And I thought that the juxtaposition would help productively, as I said, illuminate both the continuities and the discontinuities between the ways that we are approaching the questions of political aesthetics.
And so, given the complexity of this book, what are you working on now?
Aside from taking a little bit of a break, I will say, no, I'll tell you what, I mean, most immediately what I'm working on, I am writing a chapter for a Cambridge History of Democracy that Sophie Smith is editing on the aesthetics of democracy. So it's obviously going to draw from some of the things in this book, but it is a more broadly pitched project, and it's in a much more historically contextualized volume. So that's something that I'm kind of working on right now. But in terms of the next larger project, I do already have a book project in mind, and that I'm developing a proposal with. I think at this point I should just say, like, it's a popular press, not an academic press. And the working title of the book is Democracy at the End of the World. And basically the book is going to try to contextualize historically the two dominant critiques of democracy and challenges to its, I would say, once hegemonic legitimating norm. I think democracy is facing an unprecedented frontal assault. On the one part, obviously, by, you know, let's just say the broader political rationality of neoliberalism, and also the different forms of authoritarianism, party-centered or leader-centered. And I'm trying to show the kind of broader historical roots of these critiques of democracy, and then to really ask if the crisis of democracy that so many of us have been thinking about and writing about in different contexts, if democracy has the resources within it to face not just the theoretically and politically mobilized enemies that are more outspoken and every day, but also the basic kind of conditions of our present, whether that means the looming catastrophe of climate change, maybe not even looming anymore, but let's just say the unfolding catastrophe of climate change, but also different technological changes that pose very fundamental challenges, I think, to democracy's resilience. So that's the broader project, and it is going to be a more popular. I mean, it's still going to be a work of democratic theory, but I am interested in engaging a more popular audience, kind of bringing some of these theoretical concerns, hopefully in illuminating ways, to an audience that is broader than political theory, democratic theory, or even democratic science. So that's going to be the project of the next book.
Well, I hope you'll come talk to me on the New Books Network when it comes out. I would love to chat with you about it.
I would be very happy to. I've really enjoyed this, Lily. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for joining me, Jason Frank, author of The Democratic Sublime on Aesthetics and Popular Assembly, published by Oxford University Press in 2021. I assume one can purchase this at Oxford University Press. Is there a brick and mortar store with an online presence that you would like to give a shout out to?
Oh, man. How about City Lights Books or Powell Books? Any of those existing brick I'll limit myself to those two since I do much of my ordering through those two bookstores anyway.
That's fine. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jason.
All right. Thanks, Lily.